Welcome to the Ollie Podcast Series, presented by the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute and Penguin Radio at Dominican University of California. This series is created by the students of the Communications and Media Studies Department, where our chair is Mari Puleggi.
Today we have a wonderful show for you guys. We are going to be interviewing the Ollie Foundation's director, Catherine Henderson. I'm going to call her Kathy. Kathy, how are you doing today?
I'm good, Lily. Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
We are so happy to have you on here. For those of you who don't know, Ollie is the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute. Kathy, could you tell us a little bit about what you do for the program and what the program does for this school?
Sure, I'd be glad to do that. We are one of about a little over 100 Ollies in the country, and they were all initially funded by the Osher Foundation, Mr. Bernard Osher, who believed in education for older adults. And it's an idea that's really caught on very big in this country because people are living a long time after they retire these days, and they don't particularly want to sit around and knit, which is what they used to do, or that was the image of what people used to do, women especially. They want to expand their learning, and times change. First of all, they missed a lot when they were in school, and secondly, things are changing all the time. There are new scientific discoveries. History goes on every day. So people who have retired want to learn, and what the Ollies do is they offer non-credit courses, and they're quite inexpensive. They're not terribly expensive. There are no grades. There's no required homework, although there's recommended homework. But the Ollies are also different. Marin is a highly educated county. Most of the people who live here, retired people, have a bachelor's degree already. And we offer courses on the senior major or graduate level. We don't offer knitting or sewing circles or some things that other Ollies perhaps in rural areas might be more inclined to offer. Ours is at a very high intellectual level. Our faculty have credentials. They're not volunteers. They get paid, and our members want to be challenged intellectually. So I should mention that we have 1,400 members, so we're pretty big. And they don't come every day. You know, some of them might only take one course a year. Others actually take as many as 12 courses a year. But that was how many members we had in the year that just ended this summer.
Great. So you're really giving older people the opportunity to not just, like you say, sit around knitting and sewing, but actually keep up with what's happening and keep up with the scientific discoveries and the news of the time.
Exactly. Exactly. To keep up with the time and to keep up with anything they miss. So a lot of people who are in technical fields like medicine really feel they missed out on liberal arts. They weren't able to take the history courses they wanted or the literature courses they wanted in college, and this is their chance to do that. So they're filling gaps in their knowledge, and they're very excited. It's a wonderful population to work with because they find it so exciting, and we are able to demand a very high quality of teaching. And we do demand a very high quality of teaching. We are very careful in whom we choose to teach them, so that the choir quality is extremely high. The quality of lecturing is just amazing, and that's why people keep coming back.
It sounds like an amazing program. Obviously, there's a lot of people who attend it, and how do you feel being in charge of something so progressive and so extensive?
Oh, well, that's a good question. I actually had retired myself. I was a university president on the East Coast, and I retired to California because my children lived here, and I had worked here previously. And the Ollie program was very new. It was just a couple years old, and the current president of Dominican at the time called me and said he thought it needed some work and some changes, and would I come and look at it as a consultant? And I just fell in love with it. I mean, I saw there were some problems and a few changes that needed to be made, but I saw this incredible potential to have a great program that really served the needs of retired people, and also that didn't have a lot of the issues that, of course, a regular for-credit institution, a college or university like Dominican has. You know, no grades, no drug issues, no dating. No dating. Well, actually, we do have occasional dating among our members, but they don't reside here, and they don't have homework, and they don't get grades. So it's like college with only the good part of college and none of the bad part.
And you said that there were some changes that needed to be made when you first were introduced to the program. Do you think you could elaborate on those things that need to be changed and how you change them?
Okay, well, actually, the director, person who was director when I got here was very overloaded on his work, and he didn't. So if anybody wanted to teach in the program, he just hired them. Anybody who walked into his office could teach. And I went to some classes. I visited all the classes, and I felt that the teaching was not adequate. It was not high quality. There were some wonderful teachers whom we kept, but basically we hired a lot of new teachers. And we also, Dominican was very supportive of the program. We, in order to get our $2 million endowment from the foundation, we had to reach 1,000 members. And first we had to reach 500 to get the first million, then we had to reach 1,000 to get the second million. So I went to the marketing people and said, if you will advance us $10,000, so we can print 10,000 brochures to send out to retired people in Marin County, we will get the university that first $1 million endowment, which the basic endowment goes into the university's endowment and stays there forever. And they did, and that's when it started to grow. And it's grown every year. I mean, it's very funny. Some years it grows by one member, and some years it grows by 150. Right. We don't know what the difference is, but it seems to keep growing. I'm sure the growth will slow down now that we're at such a big number.
What an accomplishment and what an amazing program. I'm so happy you're here to talk about it. As some of you may know, we are interviewing a lot of OLLI members, and those interviews have been going great. And just to bring it back to you, you mentioned that you were a president of a university back on the East Coast. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I was president of Point Park University, which is a college in, about the size of Dominican, actually, located in downtown Pittsburgh. So the location was very different. But I got my administrative experience, most of my most important administrative experience I actually obtained at Dominican before I went to Pittsburgh when I was the academic VP here for about 8 years. I learned a lot about colleges and private colleges and what they need. And I feel I was able to hopefully take Point Park to the next level. But my grandson was born, and I didn't want to have this job where I was there from, you know, 8 to 8 every day. And so I retired and came back to Marin County, and I planned to write a book, which was what I had done when I was a faculty member. And then I got the call from Dominican, and I decided it was much more fun to be with people, and especially to be with people who are excited about their education, who appreciate the opportunity to be here. It's better than staying home and doing dishes or whatever the things you do around the house. Okay. So here I am.
And you just mentioned about wanting to write books. We were actually talking earlier about the books and articles that you have read. I have a few of them here with me if you would like to talk about them.
Sure. Most of my scholarship it's pretty much all feminist scholarship, although it covers different periods. And it's I was very interested in the women's movement. I lived through the women's movement. I got my degree before Title IX was passed by the federal government, and at that time, it was perfectly legal to discriminate against women. I'll tell you one quick anecdote. While I was getting my degree, I taught at City College of New York, and this was right in the midst of the student rebellions of the 60s. And I, like the second day of this class, and it was a survey class in Lit, I said, you know, we're going to read King Lear, Shakespeare's King Lear. And this young man, he didn't even raise his hand, he just said, why the F do I have to read King Lear? So I said, well, actually, you don't have to read King Lear. You can leave. And then he just shut up and was behave himself the rest of the time. The reason I was able to deal with this is that I had, my very first teaching experience was junior high, where kids are not too well behaved, so I just treated him like a junior high school student. But anyway, when I went on my job interviews, I had one, for example, at NYU, and this, I don't think they had any women on the committee, the interview committee. And one guy asked me, would you be able to handle, as a woman, would you be able to handle a class? And I said, I've never actually had a problem handling a class. College students, even when they're a little fresher, not as difficult as junior high, and I taught at junior high for several years. And then the interview went on, and then another guy at the other side of the room later said, well, I just don't understand how you'd possibly be able to handle a class. So they could say things like this. At another interview, I was offered a part-time job, and the other interview was a downtown Brooklyn college, and because the pay wasn't very good, I said, would I have a parking place? And he said, oh, of course not. Even full-time faculty don't get guaranteed parking, and you would only be part-time. And I said, well, in that case, I'll think about it, but I don't think I'll take the position. And he said, face it, Mrs. Henderson, your husband works here in New York, and you aren't going anywhere. Yeah, that's precisely what he said. And all that changed, and I think it's really important for girls and women to understand how important Title IX was. When the federal government said, to the universities and to corporations, if you take any federal money, you cannot discriminate against women or African Americans or any other group, that just changed everything. And it's very interesting how much resistance there was. At my own alma mater at Columbia, the English department there had about 20 men, and they had two women, but they didn't let the woman be in the same building with the man. This seems almost laughable now, but seriously, they were put in the continuing education building, which was across the campus. And the graduate division of Columbia had something like 340 men in their faculty and three women. And their attitude was, we're not going to change this because the government tells us to. So the federal government said, okay, well, and then in that case, you're going to lose your federal funding for all the research in the sciences. And they decided that not only to hire women, but the few women they had, they gave them nice desks and nice offices so everyone could see them. So that Title IX really did change things and make a huge difference for women in this country. And but by the time I had a full-time job, I was this pretty strong feminist. I mean, I had a husband, I was happily married, I had kids, but I could still see this college where I taught. Until Title IX, they told women they would have to take a year off when they got pregnant, and they told men if they had a baby, they got a $1,000 raise. It's things, you know, we laugh at now, but they were very real at the time. And of course, they changed all that. But this was, it was a women's college, and I was teaching a course in the Renaissance, and the women said to me, the students, well, how come we're just reading men? You know, where were the women? And I said, I don't know, but they certainly weren't published. So that was when I started my research, and that was when I discovered that women had actually published all these pamphlets in the English Renaissance in the 1500s and 1600s that were really wonderful, very, very exciting, very interesting. And I decided they should be published. They were written by very educated women. There was quite a bit of Latin and Greek in them, so I asked my colleague in the classics department to work with me. Thanks. And we published about 15 pamphlets that had been written by women. Some of them used a pseudonym. A lot of them used a pseudonym because it really wasn't considered appropriate for women to write anything except religious poetry in the English Renaissance. But they were clearly by women. And that's how I got my start as a scholar. And most of my other books were written under a contract with a publisher. With a colleague, we interviewed contemporary women novelists, which was really fun to go around the country and interview them. And I also did a book on Joan Didion because the publisher wanted me to. She's a very fine writer. But to tell you the truth, it's really more fun to administer a program like OLLI than it is to sit home and do research. Even though that has a certain reward, it's very lonely and isolating. So I enjoy administration and teaching very much. I'm not teaching now, but I enjoy administration very much.
That's amazing. I'm so glad that you found a place that you are so excited to help out with and to be here. And I was looking at a few of your books and they're it's so interesting. I never thought, I guess in history you don't think that women had a lot to say because we're not really represented, and for you to go back and take the time to do this is really amazing. And you talked about being a feminist. Do you think you could elaborate? You said you started in the early feminist movement. Is that when you started identifying as that?
Right. I didn't march because I had very small children and a full-time job, but in all my teaching, I infused feminist thought. And in my English classes, I read, for example, Virginia Woolf has a wonderful essay about the difference between the women's college at Cambridge and the men's colleges. And the men ate these luxurious four-course dinners, and the women basically had like soup, watery soup for dinner. But it's an essay called A Room of One's Own by Virginia Woolf, and it's really wonderful. And I found that there had been, at different times, strong feminist movements in the past, and they just got buried. Things changed, men took the power back, and the movements died. So this women's movement was not the first in history, but it was destined to be the most significant, I think, because it really changed the laws, and it was interesting to live through, interesting to read books like Betty Friedan's book, which was very brilliant beginning to the women's movement. And I've just always been a feminist. And actually, my husband supported me. He didn't, for him, he says it's actually better to be married to someone who has a job, because then you're not the only one responsible for earning money.
Right.
So he's willing to help with the kids and help with the dishes. And he sees it as a win-win situation. Not every minute of every day, but for the most part. I hope I answered your question.
No, you did. I I'm so happy that you say that. And a lot of the times, women my age, we think that we are kind of much more progressive and feminist than people back in those days. But hearing you talk and hearing you say that you've always had this inkling of feminism throughout your life is so inspiring and really educational. I'm very happy that we had the chance to talk about this today. And when we were talking earlier about Title IX and you actually living through not having Title IX and then having it introduced, is you have such a great insight on how it works and what has been needed to change through that. And we were talking earlier about how President Trump is actually trying to get rid of Title IX.
He is. I have no idea whether he'll succeed. Presumably, there would be challenges in the courts. But I think it would be too bad if people could go back to discriminating, because discrimination is not at an end. Discrimination against women has not ended. I cannot prove it, but I personally believe that there are men who voted for Trump simply because he was a male. They didn't like Hillary, and they didn't want a woman president. I don't know how many men, not most educated men, would not vote in that way, but I think there's this lingering sexism. It's very profound in our culture, and there are studies, which I'm not really up on the studies, but there are studies which you know, demonstrate it. I had an argument with a psychiatrist once, and he said, well, it's a woman's women should raise, stay home and raise the children, really, and men should earn the money. And I said, why? If a woman is bright and educated and qualified for a job, why shouldn't she have the job and the man could stay home and take care of the children? And he said, well, the real reason is that men's laps are not as comfortable for the babies as women's laps are. And I thought, if this is your argument, it's really not much of an argument. But in any case, you know, I think, I hope that your generation is not militant, but vigilant, basically, watching and making sure you get the breaks that you deserve and that your women friends get the breaks they deserve, too.
Going back a little bit to your role at Dominican University, you were the Vice President for Academic Affairs and Professor of English starting in 1989. Could you tell me a little bit about your role in that and then maybe go on to how Dominican has changed over the years?
Sure, I'd be glad to. When I came to Dominican in 89, it had been through a hard time. The president before Dr. Fink had been killed in a plane crash. He'd only been here less than a year when he was killed in a plane crash. And the university had fewer than 1,000 students, actually. It was really small. And there was a time when it was practical to have a university of fewer than 1,000 students, especially when, you know, that most of the faculty were sisters who didn't get paid very much, and women didn't expect to have a lot of sports, and they didn't expect to have a lot of HR people or psychologists, but things were changing. So during that 9 years, I mean, my area was the academic, but I had some experience in developing new programs, and I worked with the faculty to develop the adult degree program, which we still have. It's not as big as it was, but it's still important. And during those 9 years, I mean, my role was academic, and I didn't have any role in fundraising, but the university was able to build a gym and to build a science center. And when I first got here, there was a little gym, but it leaked, actually. It was not very much fun to play basketball and have a water trickling on your head. So those buildings were badly needed. And enrollment got over 1,000. and continue to grow. In some ways, it was an easier time than now because there was a very big college-going population in the country at that time. And if you just created the product, you know, the students came. Now there's much more competition for students. It's the population of 18-year-olds is not as great as it was then. And but I love Dominican. It's I've already trained my grandson so that he wants to come here. The only thing is you have to, he's only 13. You have to have a baseball team. So I told him, I thought they would have a baseball team by the time he got here, because he plays baseball. But he wears Dominican shirt jerseys and has already decided he will come here. So I'm very happy about that. My daughter graduated from here too. So it's a much more sophisticated, advanced university now. And President Marcy has a very coherent vision that includes a lot of important dimensions like travel abroad and community service. I think those are great additions to the curriculum.
Excellent. Well, we are almost out of time here. We've talked about a number of really interesting topics, the Ollie program, your life, your views as a feminist, and I just want to ask, is there anything else you want to talk about? Anything else you want to know, either personally or Dominican or Ollie, that you want to share with us?
No, I think it's great that that you're doing this. I think it's Dominican is really good because you have the opportunity to be hands-on in this way, and when you graduate, you'll have faculty who knew you and know you, and I'm sure you'll go and get a great job and someday, you know, give Dominican a lot of money so they can build the Lilly Studio of Communication Arts. So I'm very happy to be back at Dominican and appreciate this opportunity, and I'm thrilled that you're going to interview. We have so many distinguished, interesting people in the Ollie program, and I know they'll all enjoy being interviewed too.
Thank you so much, Kathy.
It was my pleasure.
As you guys know, we'll be continuing the Ollie interviews with a number of interesting people, as Kathy just mentioned. And this is all for today. Kathy, thank you so much. Everyone have a wonderful day.
Thank you for listening to today's installment of the Ollie podcast series, brought to you by Penguin Radio at Dominican University of California.